Biblical translation from Hebrew has become a growth industry. A few years ago, David Rosenberg published the Book of Jay. Last year, Everett Fox offered a version of the Five Books of Moses that strives for the texture and rhythm of biblical Hebrew in English. Now, there are some new translations of Genesis and several new books about Genesis. Some are connected to a Bill Moyers PBS series. Others were published coincidentally. Today and tomorrow, we'll hear from two of this year's translators. First, the poet Stephen Mitchell, who's previously translated the poetry of Rilke and the Psalms and the Book of Job. Mitchell is drawn to the mystery of the Genesis stories. His translation, full of radical departures from convention, leans on the scholarly approach known as the documentary hypothesis, that the Hebrew Bible is a paste-up, a compilation of several different traditions. He presents the stories not in the usual sequence of verses, but separated according to the attributed hand of authorship. They're known by letters, for example, E and J.
What we have, what we've been handed down, is a work of a late editor working hundreds of years after the original authors wrote down these stories, which were already ancient. And the book as a whole is handed down to us as a continuous narrative. Now, that has certain advantages, but it also can be very confusing because we have two flood stories, two stories of Hagar and Ishmael, etc. And I felt that it was very helpful to people to see that these are written by different authors of different talents with different interests, and it's much clearer when I separate them.
You, like other literary people who've approached the Bible in recent years, have found the J hand, the Yahwist hand, to be by far the better poet than the other hands.
My sense is that he is one of the three great writers in Genesis. I feel that E is as great a writer. He is the author of the story of the binding of Isaac and of one of the Hagar and Ishmael stories.
E is the Elohist hand.
The Elohist.
He uses the word Elohim to describe God, most often.
Correct. And the greatest of all, it seems to me, is the author of Joseph and His Brothers, who's a distinct writer from J. So it's a collection of enormous greatness with at least three of the greatest writers who ever wrote.
I wonder if you could read for us now. And one story I'd love to hear you read is Jacob wrestling, as many of us grew up with it, with an angel.
Yes, that's a very strange story and a fascinating one. And the angel turns out not to be an angel. And Jacob was left alone, and a being wrestled with him until dawn. And when the being saw that he couldn't defeat Jacob, he struck him on his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was wrenched out of joint. And he said, "Let me go, dawn is coming." And he said, "I will not let you go until you bless me." And he said, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, heel grasper, but Israel, he who has struggled with God, because you have struggled with God and you have won." And Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." And he said, "You must not ask my name." And he left him there. And Jacob named the place Penuel, the face of God, because I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been spared. And the sun rose on him as he passed through Penuel, and he was limping. It's a hair-raising story.
And you've tied the knot there, that if indeed the being says to him, you've just wrestled with God, and Jacob says, "I've seen the face of God there,"
yes,
then this is Jacob wrestling with God.
Yes, and not only wrestling, but defeating. And it's quite clear that it's God there, and it poses the question, what in the world does that mean? What does it mean to defeat God? Most of us, some of us anyway, know what it means to wrestle with God. But to defeat God is entirely different. And this was a very important verse to me in my many years' relationship with a Zen master. It was a kind of prior permission to kill the Buddha, you might say. And very enheartening and empowering.
Were there any moments when you felt, boy, I can feel that phrase or that line, I can hear it in the Hebrew, This is one I just can't render this one with equal power in English.
Well, one starts with an understanding that it's going to be something different. One can't reproduce the sound or the music. However, one can reinvent a music in English that is in some way an equivalent. So really it was a question of hearing in as exquisitely fine-tuned a way as I could how the prose spoke and sang and recreating that.
Read a story for us that to you presents very, very well the kind of translation that you've done and the ideas that you've brought to it.
Well, let me read part of the garden story, since that has the most charge on it for people. Now the serpent was more cunning than any creature the Lord had made. And he said to the woman, "Did God really say that you're not allowed to eat from any tree in the garden?" And the woman said, "We are allowed to eat from any tree in the garden. It's just the tree in the middle of the garden that we must not eat from, because God said, if you eat from it or even touch it, you die." And the serpent said, "You will not die. God knows that as soon as you eat from it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like gods, knowing good and evil." And when the woman saw that the tree was good to eat from and beautiful to look at, she took one of its fruits and ate, and gave it to her husband, and he ate too. And the eyes of them both were opened, and they knew that they were naked. It's a very strange story. I think until you look at it with fresh eyes, you don't understand how very strange it is to have a God who lies and a serpent who's telling the truth.
You mean that because you're not going to die? In fact, you'll be punished for this, and but you don't die.
In fact, they don't die. Mm-hmm. The serpent was quite right, and in fact, a lot of people nowadays, rabbis and theologians, try to do some fancy dancing around this by saying, "Well, what the Hebrew means is you'll become mortal." It doesn't mean that at all. It means literally you will die, and he is not telling the truth. To realize that here you have a God who lies and a serpent who tells the truth, a God who forbids the tree but puts it smack in the middle of the garden, like a parent who puts the jar of magic cookies on the kitchen table rather than locking them in the attic. Something strange is going on here.
You know, one of the strangest things about the book of Genesis, to read it through, is how often... or maybe it's not strange, maybe it's just very realistic, how often there's a problem between siblings, or there's a problem about marrying the sibling that you want to marry, or there is a husband presenting his wife, trying to pawn her off as his sibling, as his sister instead of his wife. Very odd twists on domestic familial relationships.
Well, this problem between brothers is something that is the main theme of the human drama of Genesis, and it happens in every generation. It starts with Cain and Abel, and it always is caused by the preference of a parent for one brother mm-hmm. over the others. Mm-hmm. In the story of Cain and Abel, it's the Lord's preference for Abel. The story doesn't call Abel good and Cain bad, or the sacrifice good and Cain's sacrifice bad. It comes out of the blue, and it results in disaster, always. In every generation, down to the last story where Jacob prefers Joseph over all his brothers. However, what I found most thrilling about it is that at the end, with the great story of Joseph and his brothers, everything becomes harmonious and reconciled, and it's a story that is magnificent beyond words. It's a story that Tolstoy called the most beautiful story in the world. And I think part of the reason he felt that, or at least certainly why I feel it to a great extent, is that it has forgiveness at its center, and it has a character whose progress is a spiritual transformation from the rather spoiled brat of the beginning to the great leader and shaman and wise man at the end.
Well, why don't you read us one more story? And
okay, why don't I read the greatest story written by E, and one of the most profound stories in the Bible, called The Binding of Isaac. Sometime later, God tested Abraham, and he said to him, Abraham? And he said, Yes. And he said, Take your son, your darling, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah, and burn him there as a sacrifice on one of the hills that I will show you. And early in the morning, Abraham saddled his donkey, and took two of his men with him, and his son Isaac, and the wood that he had chopped for the sacrifice, and set out for the place that God had spoken of. And on the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. And he said to his men, You stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go up there and worship and come back to you. And Abraham took the wood for the sacrifice and put it on his son Isaac. And he himself took the firestone and the knife. And the two of them walked on together. And Isaac said to his father Abraham, Father. And he said, Yes, my son. And he said, Here are the firestone and the wood, but where is the sheep for the sacrifice? And Abraham said, God will provide a sheep for the sacrifice, my son. And the two of them walked on together. And they came to the place that God had shown him. And Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood and bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And Abraham reached out and picked up the knife to slaughter his son. And God called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Yes. And he said, Don't lay your hand on the boy or do him any harm. Now I know how deeply you revere God, since you have not withheld your son, your darling, from me. And Abraham looked up and saw a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. And he went and took the ram and burned it as a sacrifice instead of his son. And he named that place Adonai Yireh, the Lord provides. And Abraham went back to his men, and they set out together for Beersheba. And Abraham stayed in Beersheba.
Poet Stephen Mitchell, reading from his new translation of Genesis. Tomorrow we'll hear from another translator, Robert Alter, whose approach to Genesis is very different from Mitchell's.